Thank you, friend. Oh,
it's loud.
Oh, it's loud. Hold on. Hello. Oh, yep. Is that better? Better? Awesome. Great. Good morning, friends. Yeah. Good job, Paul. All right. Good morning again. Good to see you all. You have to suffer with my voice at the tail end of this cold, but I think we can make it through the next little bit. I've tested many times, so it's just a cold, I promise. Okay. A bit of review about where we've been. This is our fourth week together thinking about reading Luke backwards. So reading backwards, we started with Luke's account of the cross, thinking particularly of the spectacle that's shown in that space and how that cross is a mirror into our own thrall to imperial violence. The week after that, we read that famously misread text, at least from my perspective, about Caesar and God and how we divide the world between them or not. And then last week, just to keep messing with you all, I tried to say that the great dinner parable is actually not so great dinner, that the landowner does the exact opposite of what Jesus says in the context right before that. All those stories disrupting our sense of how the world works, disrupting our sense of the values that we take for granted, disrupting our sense of how the world is meant to be. And so today we turn to Luke's sermon on the plain. We'll talk a little bit more about why it's on a plain in a second here, where we get a vivid telling of a world turned upside down. So I want to keep one question before us throughout our time together this morning is I want us to wonder, where is it that Jesus learned these radical lessons of reversal and justice? I think sometimes we assume that Jesus is this great innovator, that he's coming up with this stuff on the spot, or it's from his own fully human, fully divine. That's somehow how Jesus is coming up with these radical lessons. But I think if we are reading Luke, we see a couple indications that these are not ideas just original to Jesus. First, we see how the ideas Jesus articulates in the Sermon on the Plain are rooted in the prophetic tradition of the Hebrew scriptures, that he's learning from the prophets. The prophets also look to the margins to see God's activity. Jesus has been shaped by that prophetic tradition, learned from it, and is speaking out of that tradition, not against it. But a second source that I think will be important for us as we close our time towards Easter is to think about his own upbringing, to think about his own nurture in faithfulness, especially to think about Mary's role in teaching Jesus these lessons from the prophets and from Jewish faithfulness. Here, I think particularly of Mary's Magnificat. Think about the ways that she sings over Jesus while he is still in the womb, sings about a world turned upside down where the hungry are filled and the rich are sent away empty. To me, it's no accident that the Jesus here who is blessing the poor and expressing woe to the rich had a mother who maybe sang that song to him like a lullaby in Luke's imagination. So for us, as we're reading the text backwards, to look back and remember or try to imagine the places where Jesus learned these incredible lessons that he's going to proclaim here in the Sermon on the Plain. And again, this is an important reminder that Jesus is not so much an innovator, but he's remixing old tradition. I think Luke is interested and telling a story about Jesus, where Jesus is not an innovator, where Jesus is not a new chapter in a book that God is writing, but the continuation of the faithfulness that God has shown, is showing, and will always show. So our focus this morning is on what's called the Beatitudes, those blessings and those woes at the beginning of the Sermon on the Plain. Those Beatitudes ask us to wonder about really big existential questions that we're not going to be able to pin down this morning. What is the shape of justice? Who belongs? And what is the kingdom of God? And again, these are questions that are more than a lifetime's worth of deliberation. But I think at least to begin, we can say that it turns out that God's justice is transformative in these texts, that belonging is wide and it's unexpected, and that the kingdom of God stands contrary to most every value we tend to lift up most times. So God's justice is transformative, it changes the world. Our sense of belonging needs to expect it to be wide and unexpected, and the kingdom stands contrary to most every value we tend to lift up far too often. So that's where we begin. Before we jump into the text, I'm wondering if you have any lingering questions or insights about our work over the last 3 weeks or so. Anything that you're wondering about, anything that you've noticed that we haven't talked about in reading Luke backwards these many weeks, anything you would share at this point? Please. Aha, right, yeah. To the broader audience, yeah. So it's a great question. So we'll dig into this a little bit about which of the narrative audiences is being imagined in these spaces. So part of the trick of reading a narrative like the Gospel of Luke, and same thing with the Acts of the Apostles, is that there's so many layers of audience, right? So as you're reading, there's the people that Luke is narrating or hearing the sermon for the first time. So it's the disciples or the crowds that are gathered. But that's not the only audience through that text. It's also, Luke is also imagining us as readers overhearing that scene as well. So even if Luke's Jesus is just speaking to the 12 at the beginning, for example, Luke is still knows that we're going to be overhearing that teaching as well. So that couple layers of narrative audience, we'll talk some about as we jump in. Great question. Anybody else in the last couple of weeks? Anything else that you want to revisit? Dave Davis, you're not supposed to be here. I'm just kidding. I'm glad you're here. Great. So in the choosing of the 12, you have certainly the reconstitution of the 12 tribes, the drawing together of the exiled people of Israel. But what I'm really struck with is the role of the 12 and what is it that they do. In a few chapters, Jesus is going to send out the 12 disciples and enable them to do Jesus things. They're going to heal people. They're going to preach the good news. They're going to exorcise demons. They're going to do all the things that Jesus is able to do. And it's not good enough to do it just once. He's going to do it again. This time he's going to send out 70 or 72, depending on the text and what they tell us. He's going to send out this group of 70 to do Jesus things, to heal, to preach, to exorcise demons. I'm reminded here that in the choosing of the 12, Jesus is reminding us that even during his earthly ministry, he's not doing the work of the kingdom alone. Jesus is not by himself in proclaiming that good news and doing the extraordinary acts that reflect the shape of the kingdom and the shape of salvation. He's empowering others to do the same. It's as if the good news spilled over his own body and his own authority as his disciples led. And even when the disciples fall short, when they fail, when they don't notice the shape of the kingdom, the power of Christ is still with them. Jesus calls them, knowing all too well their frailties. And their frailties are perhaps best exemplified by the calling of Judas. This is something the gospel writers do not avoid. It's something that they confront. The fact that Jesus, among the 12 that he chooses to be closest to him, includes someone who will turn his back on him eventually. I've been thinking a lot more in some of the teaching I've been doing, and some students have helped me think about this, is to think about the trauma that would have coursed through the community in light of the betrayal of Judas. At the beginning of the book of Acts, Peter will stand up, he will read some psalms, and he will say, it's time for us to replace Judas. We need to be 12 once again, not 11. And Acts will recount the story of Judas's demise there. There's a different story in Matthew and one in Acts. That's two different accounts of Judas's demise. But either way, it's a way of saying we need to move on and fill the place that he left empty. I've been wondering more and more how many of the people gathered in that early church were ready to move on from Judas. So he had been their friend, he had been their companion, he'd been doing all the Jesus things, right? He'd been exorcising demons, he'd been healing people. And he wasn't the only disciple to fail, to fall short, to not understand who Jesus is, who Jesus was, what Jesus was calling them to do. I wonder if those people, there's 120 believers gathered around Peter, hearing about the need to have a 12th disciple. And I wonder if some of them thought, yeah, let's do this. I am done with that Judas character. I never want to hear his name again. He wasn't one of us. He betrayed us. But maybe there were some other people in that community wondering, well, I remember Judas, and he was my friend. I can't believe he still did this, but I'm not ready to move on from him. But this community is one that has been through trauma. They saw their friend die in this torturous way, as we saw in the first week, but also a community that experienced division even within themselves. So let's read backwards here in the story of Judas, right? So if we know where Judas is headed, what does Luke think about Judas? What does he want us to think about this character? So clearly, he wants us to think right away that his primary characteristic is that he's a traitor, that he turns his back on Jesus. And yet I'm wondering, in light of what we're going to read here shortly about blessings and woes, if there's not space for us to read against the grain of the text, so to speak, and imagine the different reactions that people might have had to their friend Judas turning their back on Jesus. Is Judas irredeemable? Does Judas have a place in this community? After all, in Luke, when Luke recounts the Last Supper, and Jesus is telling all his friends, the 12, that they're going to be judges over Israel, that they're going to rule over Israel in the significant sense, Judas is still with them. So we continue here. So he came down with them. So he comes down from the mountain and stood on a level place. This is quite a contrast, again, to Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. With a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon, they had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all in the crowd were trying to touch him, for power came out from him and healed all of them. So he comes down off the mountain to a level place. And I wonder if for Luke, a level place is a particularly appropriate setting for this. It's a terrible setting if you think about the logistics of this. He doesn't have a microphone. Probably, you know, unless you're like the 7 feet tall, you probably can't see him. You may not be able to hear him. A mountain makes more sense. It makes him look like Moses, and people can hear him and see him. But this level place might be symbolically important for Luke. That here Jesus is meeting people exactly where they are, meeting them at this level place, a place where equity reigns. So maybe a level place is appropriate for Luke, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense with this many number of people. Second is, notice the great yearning of the people to be near to Jesus. A great crowd of his disciples, so here including the 12, of course, but even more than that, a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coasts of Tyre and Sidon, they've come from all over the place to be near to Jesus. Think about not just the numbers of people, but the number of stories and griefs and needs that must have been embodied in that community. To Jesus, this isn't just a faceless multitude. It's all the deep need of his people. So third, we might wonder, what is it that they're after? What is it that they seek? So here in the middle, we see that they want to hear his voice, which is, I think, an important Lucan theme here. And they think they're seeking not just his teaching, not just the content of his teaching, but if we think back to Luke chapter 4, they're after the authority of his voice. In chapter 4, the first two healings that Jesus performs are exorcisms. And in both cases, people marvel at his voice because of the power of his voice. because of what his voice accomplishes. The way his voice can heal broken bodies and exorcise the demon-possessed. The way his voice, his words, can change the world. So they're after his voice, but they're also after his healing, the way he can set bodies right, and the way that those bodies who've been set right can be made right in community as well. One of the things I emphasize in my teaching about Luke, and maybe even all the Gospels, is that when Jesus heals individuals, it's not just for those individuals. It's for the whole community that's around them as well. And last is his ability to liberate the troubled. Those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. This reminder of the power of exorcism, the power of being released from demonic possession, which I think if we're honest, it's a little uncomfortable for most of us, I think, in the West, because that seems like a superstitious thing, right? It seems a little strange. Maybe it's for movies and The Exorcist, but that's about it, not in the church. When's the last time you did an exorcism, Dave, at Nassau Church, right? A long time ago, right? But it's at the heart of so many of these stories. So let me just say briefly here, I think one of the ways I've been thinking more about these unclean spirits, these demonic possessions, is to think about these invisible forces in our lives that wreak death and havoc and destruction wherever they go, and that no one seems to be able to control. These forces in our world that go beyond the tangible realities that we know and have this grip upon people's lives. That is the kind of thing that Jesus is curing in this space. And the power that Jesus has, you'll notice at the end, is one that almost exudes Jesus' body. It goes wherever he goes. Power came out from him and healed all of them. Here, the importance of that power, the shape of that power, the aim of that power has to be clarified with what Jesus is going to tell them here in a second. Because this kind of power, the power that transforms people's bodies and makes them right, I think can be seriously misunderstood without the context of the Sermon on the Plain. So this is the context of these famous words of Jesus. The deep needs of a people, the yearning of a community for liberation, and a power that if we do not understand, might very well lead us astray, might even be able to destroy us. So that's the context pieces of this. Anything else that you all notice? Anything else that you'd want to say? Any other questions that you have? All right, let's get to the Beatitudes then. Finally get where we're going. All right, starting in Luke 6, chapter verse 20. And Jesus looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy. For surely your reward is great in heaven, for that is what their ancestors did to the prophets." We're confronted first with a significant question, and that's, what is a blessing? What does it mean to be blessed? Here Jesus is taking this term that we think we understand and applying it to folks that we wouldn't imagine are themselves blessed. And I think for us, in our context, we have to think really carefully, how is it that we distinguish between luck and blessing? And maybe that much more pertinent for us, how do we distinguish between privilege and blessing? How do we distinguish between structures set up to make our lives easier by making the lives of others harder? How do we distinguish that from the kind of blessing that Jesus is articulating here? Here for Jesus, blessing is the domain of the downtrodden, the harmed, the broken. Blessing is theirs to the poor, the hungry, those who weep, not as an accomplishment, not as something they earn, but as a gift from God. What I was struck by in looking at these texts again is thinking about poverty and hunger and grief, to think about the importance of how these states are embodied, right? These aren't just matters of thinking or of the soul. These are embodied conditions, but also to think about the emotional states that these embodied conditions bring with them. That poverty isn't just a status about how much money you have in your account, but the way that you can relate to your neighbors, the way that you see yourself, the way that others see you, and that hunger isn't just a physical condition, it's also an emotional condition, a fear of not wondering where the next meal might come from, of worry about what this is doing to your body, what this might be doing to your family. And the way that grief especially is this deeply emotional possibility, this deeply emotional condition that we find ourselves in. So might we assume that these are states, poverty, hunger, grief, that these are states of those, many of those who are in Luke's community? It's certainly the case that Jesus seems to assume that people in the crowds are among these folks. Blessed are you who are you who are poor. Blessed are you who are hungry now. Blessed are you who weep now. That is, that for many to whom Luke is writing, poverty, hunger, grief are not abstractions that they need to think about and imagine themselves into, but vivid, lived, everyday realities for them. And that they would receive this good news as nothing but a transformation of the world as it is, not as a list of principles for better living. Jesus goes on to say, blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you. And notice the period is not after this defame you, it's on account of the Son of Man. So just because people don't like you doesn't mean that you're being a good Christian. Just because people reject your ideas doesn't mean you're doing things right. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you on account of the Son of Man. And the last place that Jesus leaves us is this little saying at the end, for that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. Again, if we're reading backwards, we might look back to Luke chapter 4. And there Jesus preaches his first sermon, and one of the last things he says there is that no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. And to me, that's a key text for understanding how Luke understands what prophets do. Prophets rile up people because prophets tell people hard truths that they know, but they don't want to hear. Prophets tell us things that if we're honest, we really know about ourselves, but we don't want to look at. We don't actually want to recognize. We don't want to receive. And what people do is to reject the prophets. They kill them, they reject them, and years later, they might create a holiday for them or put a statue up for them, but in the moment when they're alive and well, they are rejected. So Jesus says, you're in good company because you are in the company of prophets when you are rejected in this way. So those are the blessings. But with these blessings come woes as well. And if we have a hard time figuring out what to do with blessings, woes are a whole other matter altogether. So Luke continues, but woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets. So blessings have a mirror. And that mirror is these woes. Think about how the poor, the rich, the hungry, the full, the grieving, those who laugh, when they revile you, hate you, exclude you, when all speak well of you. These are contrasts built here. And first, we might wonder what Jesus means by woe here at all. Well, of course, it's the opposite of blessing, right? So blessing is on one side and woe is on the other. And if blessing is not luck or privilege, that if we remember that blessing is a divine gift, then woe must be something like a divine judgment. It's God expressing God's desire for something other than what's being condemned here, what's being sought, what God is seeking to correct. For me, the most haunting line of this is right at the beginning. Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. That the privilege of earthly wealth, earthly excess, and earthly delight is a consolation of sorts, one that is delightful in its own ways, but that Jesus is saying falls short of the riches of the kingdom of God. You think it's consolation. You think it's protection. You think it's joy. But it's not. It is woe. It falls short of what the shape of the kingdom is. So we wondered with the blessings if there are folks in the community of Luke's own community that find themselves among the poor and the hungry and the grieving. We might also wonder if in Luke's community there are those of us who find ourselves here in the consolation of unearned privilege, in the consolation of pure luck. And how are they meant to respond to these woes? How are we meant to respond to these woes? Woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who are full now. Woe to you who are laughing now. Notice that none of the conditions here are conditional. It just says rich, not rich and greedy. It's just full people who are full, not just who are full and ungenerous. It's not those who laugh at others, but just people who are laughing now. It's a binary setup between blessings and woes, and there's not much middle ground to be seen here. And I think this is often the way of the prophet, to cleave the world into halves, to help us see where we find ourselves. In a lot of ways, this might be unsatisfactory to us, because a lot of us might find ourselves in all these different places in different moments. But the prophet has this searing binary, this searing vision of the world cleaved into two between blessing and woe. We might think about where we place ourselves here and how we think about it. Why is this computer doing this? There we go. No, go away. Go away. There we go. And notice here, too, that being well received is not a guarantee of faithfulness either. So just because people reject you doesn't mean that you're being a good Christian, but also just because people like what you have to say doesn't mean that you're being faithful either. And again, it's what their ancestors did to the false prophets. I'm wondering, as we read these texts together, where you find yourself. Do you find yourself feeling blessing or woe this morning when you hear Jesus speak? I think most of us will not find ourselves in one binary or the other. We've gone through a season where grief has felt particularly sharp, where we've lost a lot. Some of us have lost people we love. Some of us have lost time with people that we love. Even if we didn't lose them to death, we lost years in the last 2 years. We know what that grief looks like. And maybe hearing that grief, there's blessing to be found there through God's grace, might reach our ears in a way that we need. But if I'm honest, I know I often find myself on the woe side of things, finding myself somebody who has enough, in a lot of ways rich, in a lot of ways full, in a lot of ways full of joy, and not a whole lot of challenge. So what do we do with these texts? Sure.
So what I thought of from these binaries is that when I look at them, you can do something about being rich. You can do something about being hungry. But a lot of times grief just happens to you because of circumstances outside of your control. And so I really struggle with that.
Yeah.
This last one in particular.
Yeah. Oh, so I should repeat that because people want to hear that. So the sense that when it comes to poverty and richness, we can do something about that, right? So if you find yourself rich, you can divest yourself of that in some ways and align yourself with the poor. If you have all that you need when it comes to food, you can share what you have and help the hungry. But when it comes to grief, that seems to be something that happens to us more than something that we can choose. I wonder if in Luke's imagination that all these are more alike than not, but I'm really struck by this, that that our richness and our where we place ourselves when it comes to whether economics or how well-fed we are or how we feel has a lot to do with where we put our feet. That in many ways, those are choices. And this is, right, that grief can happen to any of us, but how do we shield ourselves from the griefs of our neighbors? Do we shield ourselves from the grief of other people and kind of hold that at arm's length? But I want to think more about that. It's a really good, great insight. Please.
This doesn't change your ability to do anything about it, but I've been thinking about this grief. At the newsreels from Ukraine.
Yeah.
Of their way of life.
Yeah.
And so I think about, when I look at these things, I try to think about, you know, the rich and the hungry and the laughing as those who are privileged. That laughing is more about privilege.
Mm-hmm. Than joy, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sad about losing your way.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that the insight there was that, you know, thinking about folks in Ukraine, to think about the kind of grief that they're carrying around of loss of place, of a loss of family, of a loss of being able to feed themselves, that's a different kind of grief than losing a loved one, for example. I think the only place I might wonder about that a bit is that when it's for me, I wonder about the danger of getting into any sort of grief Olympics, right, to say, like, which grieves are worse than others. However, I do wonder if part of what grief does for us is to enable us to have some empathy for the kind of different kinds of griefs that other people face. So to lose a loved one might open us up to understand the kind of grief that would come from somebody fleeing for their lives, with children in hand, dragging them across, whether it's Ukraine or the border between our country and Mexico. That grief brings us into that space to understand one another that much more. All right, let me say one more thing and then we'll close here. I just want to give a little bit more context for the end here. Jesus tells us some of the things we might do. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. These are the instructions given to both of us who experience blessing and woe, to the rich and to the poor. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. It's this transformation of what it means to be in relations of reciprocity. Give to everyone who begs from you. If someone steals stuff from you, do not ask for it back. It's a reorienting of the world. I do wonder here a bit about that some of us are more vulnerable than others, and that these clear instructions can become quite destructive to folks. So if anyone strikes you on the cheek, would probably sound very differently to someone who doesn't experience this every day and kind of thinks of it as an abstraction, as opposed to somebody experiencing abuse day in and day out. Jesus can't possibly be telling us in a context of that kind of abuse to stay there. Moreover, the other piece of context we might add very briefly, it's what happens right after the sermon on the plain, is that Luke talks about two more healings that Jesus does. One is to a centurion who has a servant whom he loves. The centurion has power and riches, certainly, is full, and he receives Jesus' blessing. And right after that, we hear about a widow who loses her husband, loses a son, is in deep grief, and she too receives a blessing from Jesus. What do we do with that context? blessing and woe, woe and blessing. I think the challenge in this important teaching of Jesus is not just to intellectualize or make this a cognitive decision that we can will for ourselves. This isn't a test where you have to get the answers right. I think what Jesus is calling us to is a whole way of life. That blessing and woe is not even a list of rules to follow. It's an orientation to a world that does not understand blessing or woe. We're not good at either. Because blessing is not mere abundance. Blessing is a gift that God aims precisely at the margins of the world. And woe isn't just a way to reject people and revile them and exclude them. Woe isn't just a way to pick sides. Woe is a clarion call to align our lives with God's reign. A reminder that the joys of today are not guarantees that we are in God's good graces, while others are clearly under God's curse. It's a reminder that just because we have it good and others have it bad, doesn't mean that God loves us more. In fact, it might mean the opposite. I think for a lot of us, maybe just for me, it's far too easy to map God's grace onto privilege and luck, and especially the acquisition of stuff. But I think these blessings call us to something more difficult, maybe more beautiful too. I think there's another question here in the back. Is there another other questions, other thoughts? Then we can wrap up our time together. I think we have like 4 more minutes. And then here. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. So wondering if laughing really is the opposite of weeping, and that, you know, Matthew handles this a bit differently. I'd have to go back and look at the Greek a little bit more closely. I didn't look at this part in particular. But it is a strange binary. Right? So rich and poor, okay, we get that. And hungry and you've got all that you need, we get that. But you're right, I think, like, what is it that's being, what is it that's being woed here? Because I think, remember how Luke narrates Jesus? He loves a good time, right? He loves a good drink. He loves a good party. He likes to eat. He's a glutton and a drunkard. And you can imagine that those meals are full of lots of laughter. So Jesus can't be just woeing laughter as a whole. But it's pretty clear, right? It's a binary. It's like those who grieve and those who laugh. And is laughing then this condition of disconnect from the needs of your neighbors, from the griefs that they carry? Maybe woe in this context is this inability to connect with folks who've lost all that they have. I do wonder about this, and just in our own context right now, like this, just knowing that there are folks huddled in subway tunnels and folks walking these long distances in the Ukrainian cold, and like we're just going on with life. Is that the contrast, the kind of grief that they're carrying on those roads and the kind of everyday ease that a lot of us are experiencing? Is that the distinction? So I wrestle with that too, so I think it's a good point. So here and here and then here, Kathy.
Reading the text, I couldn't help but think get punished for not being righteous. And here he says, if you are rich, doesn't matter. You're bad in the future, and otherwise the poor are going to be well off.
Yeah.
And still to this day, I believe today, you will find people say, if you're poor, it's your own fault.
It's your own fault, yeah. Yeah.
And correcting that, saying, this is not it, you are going to be rewarded, whatever. So, I believe in the in this context, it is a very powerful statement for what Jesus is about.
Yeah, helpful, good. So to repeat, there's a wondering here, especially about Old Testament texts, that seems to suggest that if you have riches and property and children, that you're somehow in a place of blessing. And if you lack that stuff, then you're in a place of curse, perhaps, so you're out of step with God. I mean, we see some of that. I think throughout the text of Scripture, you see this wrestling, right? The sense that that earthly blessings can align with God's blessings. And I think that's true. There's a fundamental truth to that, like that there's a way in which God can bless us with things that we need, with rain from the sky, with sumptuous food and people that we love. There's a truth to that. But you're right, I think there's another truth that Jesus is here pointing to, a truth that I think we see in the prophets as well. So this isn't just, again, Jesus' innovation, but the truth that we can't just map our privilege, our luck, onto God's grace. That we have to be far more careful in thinking about, just because people are in that state as opposed to that state, that doesn't necessarily map onto what God imagines for the world. All right, y'all, it's 10:15. Corey isn't here to shift us out, but I'll hang out. If you have other questions or other thoughts, I'm happy to chat more, but thank you so much. So next week, we are going to talk about, I don't remember now. We're talking about Luke, and it's going to be before chapter 6. Oh, the temptation account, yes, this is a good one. Yeah, so the three temptations that Jesus faces in the wilderness. I don't know what I would do without Miss Carol. Thank you, Dave Davis. Thank you. Dave Davis didn't remember. Miss Carol always helps us out. Awesome. Thank you all. We'll see you next week.